Welcome to Mind Shifts. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I am your fellow traveler along this journey of deconstruction and discovery. Thanks for joining me for another edition of this podcast. I'm excited to be bringing you a conversation that I had with a friend of mine named Seamus Clark. Now, I have to say right off the bat, and we talk about this in the interview coming up in just a minute, that is actually a pseudonym. That's not his real name. Now, why does a person need to go on a podcast and use a false name? Well, I'm going to let him explain a little bit about that. But he comes from the South of America. And the culture that he is steeped in or grew up in is such a part of the Bible Belt and such a part of the evangelical Christian American culture that he felt like he really couldn't use his own name. He's in this journey of deconstruction and discovery, but he's got a family. He's got friends around him that are still very much a part and parcel of this evangelical Christian American Southern culture right in the buckle of the Bible Belt. And it's absolutely fascinating to me to think that in this day and age that a person, in a sense, can't be free to be themselves. But yet, this is the reality of the situation that we're dealing with. And so he felt like he needed to protect himself, his family, from coming out, as it were, and being true to who he is in this process of deconstruction. Now, I met Seamus as part of the Ex-Evangelical group on Facebook, which I would highly recommend that you join if you are a person like me and like Seamus. You're on this road of deconstruction and discovery. Maybe you're coming out of the evangelical, the fundamentalist Christian culture. You're asking a lot of questions. You're wondering what's it all about. But at the same time, you don't feel the freedom like Seamus doesn't feel this freedom to come out and just say, look, this is where I'm at. I'm giving up on the church. I'm perhaps even giving up on God. Where are you at on the scale? Where are you at on the spectrum? Well, you will be interested to listen into this conversation that I'm going to bring you in a minute between myself and Seamus, because we're going to cover a lot of ground in part one of this episode today, and I'm going to be bringing you part two next week with Seamus Clark as we finish this discussion. One thing that is really cool that I've really benefited from meeting people like Seamus is that it makes you feel like, yes, I'm not alone in this thing. I'm not the only one who comes out of this background. And as we talked a few weeks before we hit the record button on this episode, we found out that we have a ton of things in common. Even though he grew up in the South and I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle area, we came out of a very similar background and we have a lot of stuff in common, as I say, and we were able to share stories and compare notes, basically, and it makes you realize there are thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people who are coming out of the church, who are walking away from everything, not just the church, but their faith or their inherited beliefs, what they were taught to think, what they were taught to believe is the truth. And they are saying, wait a minute, I can question this stuff and I am free to find a new path in terms of spirituality or just this journey of this thing we call life. That is why I keep doing this podcast. That's why I want to bring you conversations with real people, not necessarily big Christian names, big celebrities or whoever, but I just want to talk to real people who live in the real world. And if I can help you along that path, then I am more than happy to do that. Now, I'm going to say before I bring you this interview with Seamus Clark in just a minute that you can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can also find me on Instagram at MindShiftPodcast. You can also support the work of MindShift on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/MindShiftPodcast if you want to be a patron of this show and become a part of the closed Mind Shift podcast group on Facebook, as well as some of the other rewards that are coming out in 2018 for supporters of this show. So let's go on and get into part one now of my conversation with Seamus Clark, that's in air quotes, Unbuckling the Bible Belt, Deconstructing Christianity in the Deep South, Part 1. I am here with Seamus Clark. You are coming to us from the deep, dark south of America. Is that true?
That is correct. Glad to be here. How are you? Yeah,
thank you so much for being on the show. Now, we have to say right off the bat that the name Seamus Clark is actually not your real name. Why do you feel like you need to use a pseudonym to tell your story and talk about your experiences?
Well, that's a great question. Really, the need for a pseudonym, I mean, I could go without it and just bust the doors wide open, but really I'd say the main reason is growing up in the southeastern United States, it is the buckle of the Bible Belt, if you will. You know, so much of your identity is tied up in kind of walking the tightrope of evangelical culture, and especially, you know, we'll get into it more later, but I was just suffocated to some degree with evangelical culture and just going to church all the time and Christian school, et cetera, et cetera. And so to break away from that system that you've grown up in and that everybody is embedded in is a fairly bold move. So at this point in time, at least, I think it is a necessary thing to use a pseudonym to do something of this nature.
Yeah, and your wife, obviously, there's economic repercussions, which I think is a fascinating thing. Because we talked a couple of weeks ago, we had a really good conversation, and we've kind of become friends on Facebook, really, through part of the Exvangelical Facebook group, haven't we? And I think we resonate a lot in our sort of background. And when you were describing your life, I kept saying, you know, these are the same experiences I had growing up in Christian school, growing up in church, going to summer camp, Christian summer camp, and all so many things. That it struck me as this is
everything that's available.
Everything that's available. And yet the difference between you and I is the fact that I didn't grow up in the deep south where you're at and you're still there. I grew up in the northwest up in Seattle area and lived in Portland. And now we've been over here in the UK for nearly, 12 years actually. And it's a completely different context, isn't it, to what you're still in? And I'm fascinated by the fact that you're still there and you feel that need to, that you need to protect your identity and that of your wife. That's a fascinating thing to me.
Yeah, it is. It's quite the dynamic. And just to kind of jump into some of the points that you just made, I think it's interesting growing up as you did in the context of the Northwest United States, because to me growing up, in terms of a stereotype, at least what I knew was that, you know, Seattle, Portland, et cetera, was very liberal, politically and socially and, you know, just kind of the polar opposite of what I was used to. But it's funny how we can both be in the same materials that our parents were giving us. And from our point of view, they were brainwashed by this kind of mindset. And it can be on opposite ends of the country. And then in terms of the UK, I think, you know, I'm a bit jealous that you're there because growing up, I found some sort of respite and an escape in music that came from the UK. So I love tons of bands from England, like all the Manchester bands, just the whole sound, of course, U2. That was somewhat accepted in Christian circles because of their ties to Christianity. Although it's different than it was in the South, but they at least had the label of Christians early on, so that helps to gain them acceptance.
We used to think they were a Christian band. I remember my brother-in-law, that was the one band that when I was in Christian high school, the one band that we were kind of allowed to listen to, because even though they were from Ireland and they were technically Catholics, we said, well, that was close enough, you know. So my now brother-in-law at the time, we went to high school together before I married his sister. But we had U2 posters. We used to listen to all that. And that was the one of the few bands that we could actually listen to. Now, I think it's different because maybe the difference, I don't know, in the Northwest where I grew up, yes, it is very liberal politically. It's very eclectic, Portland, Seattle. But my parents felt like they had to protect us from the encroachment of that liberal world. And maybe that might be the difference. I don't know, because it certainly wasn't the Bible Belt. But I grew up in church, and it was the sense that they needed to protect us from. So we didn't have a television. We weren't allowed to listen to rock and roll music.
and they tried to shield us from evil things in the, out there in the world. And they were very much part of the Bill Gothard umbrella of protection theology and all the rest of it. So I don't know if that resonates with what your experiences are. I don't know what it's like to grow up in the Bible Belt, really.
Well, I mean, you're speaking along the same lines in a lot of ways. Like, we had a television, of course, or not of course, but we had a television, but it was very, you know, controlled as to what we watched. One particular thing I like to relay is, you know, I wasn't allowed to watch Scooby-Doo because there was, you know, ghosts and spirits and whatnot, which is silly because, you know, if you watch the show, any episode, you know, it's some old guy under a mask. It's not really a ghost, but that seems to be lost. That seems to be lost on my mom. So I would have to sneak around to watch that show and anything, Smurfs, I mean, all that kind of jazz, like when you're a kid, He-Man, I mean, it just gets ridiculous how we were kind of kept, quote, quote, protected from these things because they were viewed as a threat. So we did have access to the TV and stuff, whereas you said you didn't. But yeah, it's just overall in the South, I mean, everybody is expected to go to church, to be polite, to be happy, to put on this polite face. Of course, you know, in the South, you have Southern hospitality, and it's just a veneer of, like, niceness, which doesn't really jive with the spectrum of the human condition. There's times when you're not happy. There's times when things don't go great, and you're angry, you're frustrated, and to be able to express or to not be able to express those emotions of anger or frustration or whatnot is really harmful, I think, and that's partially what you get in the South, at least in my experience.
Well, I think there's definitely a commonality between you and me. Even though I didn't grow up in the South, we were expected to put on that Christian veneer as well. I can remember many a Sunday, you know, driving to church while my mom was screaming at us for being late or whatever on the way to church. And then as soon as we pulled in the parking lot, she'd say, "Now listen, put on a smile. Everyone has to look happy for going into church." So we had to go in there we always sat in the same pew every Sunday, and we put on the plastic smile, we wiped the tears away, really. And that's, you know, so there was a facade that we had to present as well, put on the mask and look like you're happy. And it's very stunting, as you say, emotionally, because you're thinking, wait a minute, isn't church supposed to be the place where you can be yourself, where you can come unburden yourself? And yet we find it's exactly the opposite. Right. You actually become a different person that's not even close to being who you really are. And you learn to play that game. And it can be a very destructive thing, a very toxic environment, can it?
Oh, yeah. It's brutal. It's just, you know, it's doused in bullshit, because what happens is you compartmentalize, you stuff down, you do not have healthy expression of emotions or feelings when you really need to. And what you were pointing to is that you can have a situation at home and an atmosphere at home that is fairly intense at times, where you have, you know, yelling and high emotions going on. And then you're somehow supposed to switch that off because you're supposed to look like you have everything together. Because, of course, if you have Jesus, you know, you have everything together, right? That's the
magic Jesus.
That's the assumption that you're that you're all together now because you have figured out life, or you have the key to life because you have Jesus. Yeah,
Bible. Don't forget the Bible, too.
Oh, yes.
Somehow the Bible has to factor into this.
What's so crazy? Sorry, what's that?
It's somehow the take on the Bible has to factor into it as well, because if you're looking at the Bible as some sort of like holy answer book that's got all the answers to life's problems, then you're putting that into the mix as well, and feeling this sense of satisfaction that you've got all the right answers, you've got everything figured out, you're going to heaven when you die, you've got your golden ticket.
Yes.
So you're laughing. You're doing really well. But actually, as you say, you're not doing well at all.
Yeah. And what's really funny is, or I don't know, funny, sad, it kind of all mixes together in this situation, I think. But what's strange is that, like you said, you go to church, you put on a happy face, but it is a place where you're supposed to be completely like open to the omniscient one, right? So God knows everything already. So why are you trying to put on a show for these other people that you're surrounded with? But that's essentially what happens is you go in, you do the rituals, you raise your hands during the songs, you look happy, when somebody asks you how you're doing, you say, I'm doing great. God is good all the time. All those little sayings that you learn to say and you see other people doing when you're a kid. But something inside you is creating anxiety because you're saying, wait, this isn't real. This is not who I am all the time. Sometimes I don't feel great. Sometimes God feels distant. Does God exist? All these questions that you can't entertain, they just kind of sit in the background. They sit in the back of your mind. And it's very frustrating if you are the type of person that I see myself as, and I'm sure you do as well, the person who questions, who has a mind and a brain to think, and you are engaging these questions that come up inside of you, but there's no outlet for it. There's just not a place for that in the church, it seems.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? Because as you say, these emotions and anxieties have to go somewhere. They must be processed somehow. Whether or not they're going to be processed healthily or unhealthily, they've got to, you're going to act out somewhere. And in my case, I the only outlet that I could find that actually made me feel good was pornography. When I was, 10 or 11 years old, I got addicted to pornography, and that was the one thing. I knew it was wrong because the church said it was wrong, but it was the only thing that I found, looking at it now, I could say, well, I was self-medicating. But why did I feel the need to self-medicate? Because the church wasn't meeting whatever need. In fact, it was adding to the anxiety and the guilt and the shame that I was already feeling. So it was a vicious cycle in my case that just made me feel worse and worse and worse.
Oh, totally. That's a whole ball of wax right there. I had a very, very similar trajectory and journey as you did in that respect. Same thing. Pornography was this thing that entered into your life around the time of, for me, it was about 12 years old, but following on the heels of some sexual abuse, that is where I ran as well to self-medicate, because it is in a lot of senses, it's a drug. It mimics a drug in the way that your mind reacts to it. But going back to what you said about the church, and that, I think that brings up a really interesting thing about the church, and even in the South and the Bible Belt, just the whole idea of sex. It's just not a comfortable subject to talk about in your family, in the church. Just the whole understanding of the subject is fairly ancient in a lot of ways. There's not a lot of openness. There's not the ability to talk things out, honestly. You just feel that you can't really bring up the subject, because in the church, there's a lot of, I don't know, ways that they will try to avoid, or they have their own ideas about sex or how things should be, especially in a marriage or between like men and women. It's just very old and antiquated in so many ways. I think it's great how nowadays in society, there's more of an openness. There's the ability to have sex education in schools. Of course, that could be overhauled even more and become more comprehensive. But there's just a struggle always between the people in the church who are trying to legislate for a certain way sex should be taught, like abstinence only type programs, which they don't create the success that the evangelical church would like to see in that respect.
Definitely.
Many times it's the opposite. I want to hop back a little bit more to this whole idea of like self-medicating and like your family life. I think that's an important thing to touch on. So we have talked a little bit in the past, but I want to bring it up again here on the podcast about our background. For me and my story, if you go back in my family's history, it's pretty brutal. And like most things with an evangelical family, you just kind of deny or you skirt around difficult issues. And for me, this was my father's background, which is a brutal thing, really, that was never talked about. And I don't even know if it could have been talked about when I was younger, because I wouldn't have understood it. But regardless, I was told certain things about my dad's past, very vague. And then once I got old enough and became more curious and a little bit more bold in my questioning, I was finally one day, I would say I was probably 14 years old, 15 when I finally did this. I was always told that my father's parents had gone two different directions. My grandfather had gone to prison, and then my grandmother had died. And that was the only thing I was told. And that's just what I accepted. I just thought, okay, great. So when I got older, I was trying to put the pieces together. And so I asked my dad one time, we were driving back from the mall one night as a family, good old malls, those are kind of going the way of the dinosaur. But we were driving home and I asked my dad, I said, hey, what happened to your mom? You said she died. How did she die? Well, he looked at my mom. They kind of had a little eye contact and a nod of sorts. And then he says to me, well, let me tell you what happened. And essentially what happened was his father caught his mother in some kind of a relationship because he was in the Navy. And when he came back, he found her with somebody else and he ended up killing her. And it was a violent death, pretty dark stuff.
Yeah, I would say so.
Obviously. So, yeah. So driving back home, it was silent in the car. And from there, I just began to process because my dad growing up in that situation, this happened when he was 5 years old. He ended up going to an orphanage and he and his siblings grew up there. I think he was about 5 years old when this happened, 4 or 5. He doesn't speak about it much, but you know, that ended up shaping his whole life from that point on. So that was a major event. And I had no idea about this until I was, you know, 14 or 15 years old. And he was somewhat of a mystery to me growing up, a quiet person, a moody person, a workaholic in a lot of respects. And I just didn't understand him. This gave me a great window into who he was and, you know, some of the building blocks of his story and his personality. So from that point on, I had much more of a compassion, whereas before I just, in a lot of ways, hated him. And that's mostly just from not understanding the guy. But as I grew older, I, you know, had more questions. And it's funny because now I'm actually back in school and I'm studying therapy. And I think this all goes back to this question of a traumatic event that happens in your childhood and how that shapes your whole life and then the life of those that come after you.
Especially if it's not processed.
Anyway,
if it's not processed in any sort of healthy way, huh? I mean, how does a 5-year-old kid deal with that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And so when you try to process this through spiritual means only, and then, you know, clinical therapy is looked down upon and you're told, you know, you don't take medicine if you're depressed. The only outlet you have is to try to go through these religious and these spiritual channels. And that just doesn't always help. It's many times more harmful than anything. I did find an outlet in, like I said, and we both share this, you know, same aspect of pornography addiction. But, you know, I found an outlet in all kinds of art. So music I loved, films I loved, books, anything where somebody was expressing or trying to, like, through the means of narrative, storytelling, trying to get to some, you know, greater truth or understanding of themselves. That resonated with me a ton. And I actually pursued filmmaking for the majority of my life. I'd say the first half of my life was completely dedicated to pursuing filmmaking.
So that's your creative outlet in a way?
Absolutely. That's what I pursued. I tried to go to film school. I did not get into film school. However, I did just teach myself. I just read books, watched films, experimented with a video camera. And then, of course, along came the nonlinear editing systems, you know, Final Cut Pro, Premiere, all those things that kind of jumped out of the box around the turn of the millennium. And then you could make things digitally. It was a lot cheaper than traditional film. So that's what I did and have done for the majority of my life. And, of course, more nowadays it's practical stuff like corporate type video production. But, you know, I've got a family now and all that kind of stuff. So you have to move away, or you don't have to, but I felt you had to move away from the pure artistic pursuit that I would have done had I still been single. And, you know, I even moved to New York for a while after undergrad pursuing filmmaking. So that was a big part of my life.
It sounds like, you know, it's one of those things you've got to earn a living. You've got to support your family. So you have to do what you have to do. But you were saying that you're now in school to be a therapist or a counselor. I mean, how much of this is, this is a major change. How much of this is related to all the things that you went through in your life that obviously even your father going through what he did, that, as you said, had an impact on you growing up. And even now today, it must still affect your relationship between you and your dad. I don't know how your relationship is now, if it's good or what. I don't know how much of that desire to be a therapist is part and parcel of this whole experience.
It is. It's completely tied to it, to be honest. It's always been a fascination, an obsession to me about just identity, like who you are, how is your sense of self formed, all these questions. And I think it's rooted in this background that my dad came from. He did not have parents essentially from the age of 4 or 5 on, and was raised in this orphanage that was based in a religious organization. You know, so he had this religion around him all the time growing up. He had questions. He had anger. He never felt he could go to therapy. He really didn't want to. And that's just, that's part of his whole generation and their avoidance of emotions and processing and all those things. You just kind of put your head down and go forward and don't really acknowledge all that stuff that's kind of brewing on the inside. But I think our generation is more in tune with that, which is a good thing by and large. The idea of trying to help people process and walk through these difficult things, my main fascination is trauma, addiction recovery, and even to some degree, like the way that someone forms their identity who comes from the position of being an orphan. I mean, that's fascinating because when you get into all these kind of details of attachment theory and like how you form your identity, if there's nobody to attach to, where do you get your sense of self? That's a huge question. That's existential type territory, but that's a fascinating thing. Yeah. So
getting into philosophy now.
Definitely talked about background. And that's just the kind of things that drive my curiosity.
But, you know, I wanted to go back to something you said. You said that the church can sometimes set you up for a failure because you have a case in a kid's life where there's a trauma, and then that kid, mm-hmm. you know, you're young enough. You don't know how to process it anyway. Your family's falling apart or it's very dysfunctional. And then if mm-hmm. you turn to the church for help, they'll give you some sort of platitude. They might throw some Bible verses at you. They might pray with you. I remember we had Steve Austin on the podcast last year, and he shared his story about being sexually abused by a neighbor kid, and his parents just decided that they were going to sweep it all under the rug. Well, he was so young, he didn't remember it, but he certainly remembered the trauma. And then he started having flashbacks when he was 14 or 15. And he came to his mom and said, I think this is around this sexual abuse. Well, she did the, you know, prayed the magic Jesus prayer and said, you're all better now.
Oh, man.
And down the road he went, and that messed him up so badly because, of course, it didn't do anything except make him think that he was healed when he actually wasn't. All the trauma was still there. All the stuff was still there from his past. And he nearly, you know, committed suicide over it. He was that messed up as the years went by. So in his telling of the story, it's an even worse thing when someone does something like that for you. It's a well-meaning person, perhaps, who's trying to say that prayer, but there's a whole lot of stuff that needs to be dealt with and a lot of help, like you say, from a counselor, from a therapist that you might need in addition to maybe what the church can offer. I mean, I know a lot of churches aren't really prepared to deal with stuff like that, are they? This is a huge problem that we find. They don't have the resources.
Yeah.
When I was a pastor, we certainly didn't, to know how to deal with someone who's coming out of, you know, serious sexual, psychological, emotional, physical abuse or whatever. We had no way to deal with that. There was nothing we could do for that person except pray for them.
Yeah, that's huge. That's huge. And that is one of the shortcomings that really does deeply, deeply affect and wound you, I think, in evangelical culture, is just the idea that you pray and everything is great, or everything will be healed. And then you just move on and you are just thankful for all that God has done for you. Well, it's not that easy. It's not that simple. You have to process through this really dark stuff and you have to sit in it. And that's something I learned in therapy myself is like, you have to sit in it. Meaning you've got to sit in the uncomfortable spaces that the church loves to avoid and just move right on past because yay, Jesus. It's just not, that's not how it works. There's a book called The Body Keeps the Score. And, it's very instructive in terms of how your body records and keeps traumatic situations. And so in your brain, in your mind, in your physical body, you have stored all these feelings and emotions that you have walked through. And in the case of sexual abuse, yes, I was abused as well by a couple of neighbor kids. And, you know, it's not something that is lightly taken. It's not something you just brush under the rug, you say a prayer about, and it's all done. That's deep, especially when you're, you know, coming up when you're 11, 12 years old, that's formative years. And what happened is, for me, it severely damaged my trust in people. So if there's somebody you know and you're friends with for years, you know, you spend a lot of time with them, and then all of a sudden the switch is flipped and then an abusive situation happens with sex, then, you know, you're not going to be very open to getting close to anybody after that. At least that was my experience. I definitely became isolated, shut down.
Yeah, it's self-protective behavior.
Didn't bring this up for years.
Yeah, it's self-protective behavior, isn't it? I mean, you do what you have to do to protect that vulnerable child on the inside that's still in there in a way, isn't it? That got hurt
Correct.
All those years ago. And if it means walling yourself off and being closed off to intimacy or whatever, then that's what you do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just it, isn't it?
I mean, you're just trying to survive.
Yeah. And you do what you have to do. And it's often carried right on into adult life. You see people that are severely emotionally stunted or immature or relationally, they have a lot of problems because of deep-seated trauma in their past that they perhaps have never dealt with. And then you add, like you said, a layer of Christianity on top of it, say that magic Jesus prayer, and they think they're healed, but they're so not. It's so much.
That's
like
you said. the farthest thing from the truth.
Well, I hope that you found that a stimulating and interesting conversation as you joined myself and Seamus Clark for part one of our conversation about deconstructing Christianity in the Deep South, or unbuckling that Bible belt. And you know, one thing that strikes me about the conversation that we had, and this is going to come out more in part two of our conversation next week, is something that Seamus refers to. It's called spiritual bypassing. And this is the idea that when you have a problem and you're a Christian, you just pray about it and everything is going to be fine. Everything is going to be just A-okay. Like he said, yay, Jesus, and all your problems are solved. And you know what? If it were true, that would be a great truth, capital T truth. You could just say a prayer and all your issues would go away. All your deep-seated problems and traumas from your past and all the issues that you struggle with would just be as if sort of God waved a magic wand and they were all taken care of. But if you've ever struggled through problems and issues and had to go to counseling and therapy, you know, as Seamus said, it's not that easy. And in fact, this can be an incredibly damaging teaching that we see coming out of many churches and many traditions. This kind of an idea that Jesus just waves his magic wand and all your problems are solved. It would be great if it were true, but as we all know, it's not that easy. If only it were that simple, if only it were that easy. And this kind of teaching can really mess people up and throw people for a major, major loop. That magic Jesus pill that Steve Austin talked about last year in one of our podcasts. And so if this has resonated with you at all, maybe this is your experience, especially if you grew up in the evangelical or fundamentalist church and you can relate to what Seamus and I were talking about, I would love to hear from you. And I know that Seamus Clark would also love to hear your thoughts, your comments, and your feedback. There are a variety of ways that you can get a hold of me on social media, as I mentioned before. You can follow me on Twitter and send me a message there at MindShift2018. You can always send me an email, and I've had several people do that, and I always respond, preachersforum@gmail.com. You can also stop by and like my Facebook page, facebook.com/MindShiftPodcast, and you can get a hold of me there as well. So there's a lot of different ways you can do that. You can also stop by my website, preachersforum.com, leave me a message or send me an email off the website, and I'll respond to you. So I would love to hear from you, and I'm looking forward to hear what you have to say about next week's conversation, part two. So stay tuned for that coming out next Friday with Seamus Clark, Unbuckling the Bible Belt, Deconstructing Christianity in the Deep South, part two, right here on Mindshift.